Hello everyone, I'm Pascal and welcome to Professors Are Cool People Too. For this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Associate Professor in Residence Darcy Dennigan, located at our store's campus. I've never taken a course with Professor Dennigan, but I always sensed something deeply authentic about her. Needless to say, I was super excited to chat with her, and I'm even more excited for you all to hear what we talked about. Professor Dennigan was hired to teach creative writing here at UConn back in 2010, and one of her favorite courses to teach is a nature writing workshop. To get a sense of what this class is like, here's a line from her course description. Be prepared for non-linear, challenging writing assignments and for invitations to meet a blank page without constraints. A piece of literal garbage will be the linchpin of all of your writing for the first third of the semester, and a pile of dirt will anchor your writing in the second third. How are you inextricably linked to this trash, this dirt? What is the loop you're living in, and how are you continuously fed back into this loop?
You know, I was hired as a poet and to teach creative writing, and I would not call myself a nature poet in the classical sense, and they needed someone to teach nature writing once the person who had been doing it for so long and was so great at it retired, and I was just terrified, and I'm still pretty terrified, but it's the class where I am learning as I go and teaching myself so much, and it's the class that is filtered into my writing the most, so that I would say that I've written things that could be classified loosely as a kind of nature writing, and that's totally due to having to teach this class. Mm. And I think it's, you know, it's the single biggest issue facing humanity. You know, it's nice to be able to talk about it every time we come to class, and not just talk about it, but to think about different ways of thinking, different words we can use, different grammar we can use, like, to, like, address that problem at the level of language, which is what writers can do.
Professor Dennigan actually went to college to study French, but later decided she wanted to pursue acting. Both of these paths didn't necessarily pan out for her.
And I loved French, but then I decided I wanted to be an actress, and so I left college and went to acting school. And then I, long story short, kind of got kicked out of acting school because I had a terrible Rhode Island accent and flunked.
So why did you choose to study English, and why did you pursue an MFA in poetry?
I did English only because reading and writing had always just sort of been there and been like a very large part of my life. I hadn't thought that that could be something I studied. I just thought that was like my life. But it turned out the best professors were there, or at least in my opinion at UMass, the best professors were there. And so I kept wanting to take their classes. Yeah, so it was sort of by default, although I'm really happy because unlike the French and the theater classes and other classes, the English classes were also my most challenging. And I can't tell you any fact I learned in college, but I remember like learning how to write and think in different ways, even though I have no facts, just methods. I was really lonely after college, and so it was really my mom's fault. She got me a gift certificate to take a community writing class in Boston, and that was it. In college, I had taken a creative writing class, but the teacher was incredibly authoritarian and basically told me, you know, your poems are terrible. If you have to write, make sure you stick to fiction because I can't read another one of your poems. And, you know, and I was like, sure, okay, great. You know, I was like, you know, whatever. I was like a typical female undergrad, like smiling, nodding, thank you, sir, for telling me how terrible I am, you know. But I took this class in Boston with this teacher, Emily Taylor, who, I don't know, I just fell in love with her. She wore like the same weird dress that seemed like it was made of drapes. She had incredibly hairy armpits, and she was like one of the first women I had like ever come in contact with who was like so herself. She had memorized, it seemed like, every poem in the world. I don't know. I think I just had like a huge like poet's crush on her. And also I felt like, oh, I could talk to these people in this class. Like, you know, they're all different ages. But anyway, I fell in love with writing poems. And yeah, I just kind of went on some steam until I could get into an MFA program. Took a couple of years, but yeah.
So you would you say that professor was very influential in your choice to pursue graduate school?
Yes, and she wasn't a professor. She was she couldn't have been more than 25 herself. She had just finished an MFA program, and for money she was teaching, you know, this community poetry class in Arlington, Mass. But I think she was just so in love with poetry and also just, you know, very encouraging. There's only like four of us in the class. She brought in all these poems for me to read. I had never really read, you know, I read like The Fairy Queen and the Canterbury Tales in college. I hadn't really read any contemporary stuff. So I think so. I think she really was. And I also had another teacher. I took another community writing workshop at Harvard Extension School. And that teacher, well, sort of anti-MFA, in terms of like anti like poetry establishment, institutional affiliation, even though he was teaching at Harvard, he was really, really incredibly supportive as well.
That's great. So I looked at your CV. And I noticed that you've taught at Roger Williams, URI, Brown, and RISD, but what specifically drew you to UConn?
Honestly, this was a full-time job, and the others were adjunct jobs, and it's incredibly difficult to be an adjunct. You know, I have two young kids, and I'm a single parent, and it's hard to have your schedule up in the air like that and not know if you're going to get classes, so I'm really grateful to have a full-time job at UConn. But I can also say that having taught at a bunch of other places, I really like the students here. I think just the range of students, the range of experiences they bring to bear on their writing and reading. They're also really ready to experiment, which is not at every school, I can say for sure.
Professor Dennegan also enjoys teaching modern drama and engaging with students in their independent studies. She's been approached with poetry chapbooks, YA novels, and textual adaptations of artwork. Talk to me about these courses.
I mean, also not qualified to teach it, but love it. And I absolutely am in love with the absurdists. I love absurdist playwrights. And I absolutely love that I can teach Ubu Wa, the Alfred Jury play, which is just, you know, basically like a takeoff on Macbeth with like a lot of bathroom humor. I love all of the plays that I get to share in there. I love learning. I mean, honestly, I love learning about these things that, you know, I don't have a PhD in them, but I love them. And having to teach is like a crash course in these certain things, you know. So... yeah, so I guess those are the two classes that, like, make me sweat the most, but also and like, so appreciative that I have the opportunity to do them. Because teaching, like, intro to creative writing, I love. I really love, but, like, I can do that, and I know I can do that. Whereas these classes, like, I never know if I'm going to be able to do it, but I love the challenge of it. And, yeah, I love what students write in both of the classes.
And independent studies?
You know, it's like it's really student driven, and in a class, it's instructor driven in that the instructor writes the syllabus, and so the syllabus can, you know, change and respond to student interests, but it's primarily initiated by the instructor in an independent study. It's totally initiated by the student. You know, they come to you with what they want to study, and like I can say, okay, you know, what have you thought about these people, or we could read these people together. But so I'm doing like one with a graduate student right now who's writing this book of essays. But, you know, and I suggested some books, but ultimately, like, she made the reading list. Worked together, we made it. I'm not there to give her assignments in any way, but just as like I'm there as a sounding board, I'm there as like a person who can help with accountability, which I think writers at every level need. You never not need accountability. And I'm also there for, you know, for feedback, which is, you know, important. I don't think that any one person should be the end all be all when it comes to feedback, but I can be one source of regular feedback.
So generally speaking, regarding your, I guess, teaching philosophy, teaching principle, like, what do you hope students walk away with after completing a course with you, whether it's the independent study, nature writing, like any of those courses?
We were just talking about this in my nature writing class because I share a bunch of students with another professor who I really love and I'm friends with, but we have a totally different approach because this person has excellent criticism and brings the excellent criticism to class and gives that criticism to the writers. And I am really against that model because, I mean, especially for undergrads, I'm really against that model because I think that it's so awesome to sit there and have someone tell you what's wrong with a piece of writing. It feels so good. It's like, oh, thank God, you know? But I also think that it's too easy. And the first thing you need to do as a writer is to hear how other people are describing your work back to you and then figure out, like, what is wrong. You know, because when you hear the disconnect between what you were going for and what people are experiencing, then you know, like, okay, this didn't come across, or this wasn't. But I think to tell a student that is, like, it helps their writing and their work get a lot better really fast, but it doesn't, like, ultimately help them when they've left UConn, I guess, because then it's like, okay, who's going to tell me what's wrong? And I, you know, I want them to have a sense of what a writing process can be for themselves, you know, like, what is their process? Like, because I think until you actually, like, know what your process is, writing is just going to keep being, like, daunting. But once you actually know, like, okay, I know my first five drafts always suck, so it's okay. Like, I can write them. I just have to, like, keep living with it, because usually around the sixth, something clicks. Or, you know, like, I know that, like, I need some kind of routine or whatever. So I want them to know a process, whether it's critical writing or creative writing. And I want them to be able to figure out some distance from their own work and sort of, like, know the difference between, like, revising and editing. Like, I feel like revising is, like, really messing with it, and editing is, like, what any, like, proofreader could do, you know. And who cares about that, you know? It's like, we have spell check and stuff for that, you know. So I want them to do that, and I think I also just want them to investigate the ways that they read and their prejudices they bring to reading, and I mean, everything. I also want them to write something that they really surprises them, they love. I want them to read something that they want to go back to at some point in their lives. You know, I don't want to analyze anything to death. I want to just get them interested enough and asking enough questions that they would go back to it, whether it's another class or grad school or just, you know, sitting on a train when they're 32, you know, with the book in their lap.
So slight redirect, focusing more on you as a writer. You mentioned, or I've noticed, that you've written plays, adaptations, essays, poems, novels. So can you just talk about what each style of writing offers you, and what do you appreciate about each of those different styles of writing?
I don't really break it up in my head like that. I think of myself as a poet, and sometimes it comes out in other ways. Like, I was just reading this piece by the writer Anne Boyer, where she says, like, she doesn't like the term lyric essay, and I won't go into everything she says, but I totally get that, because I'm like, yes, it's like making it its own genre when, like, any good piece of writing has elements of poetry in it, and blah, blah, blah. I won't go into my whole screed on that, but I think of myself as a poet, and, you know, it comes out in different ways. Yeah, like, I wrote a novel, but I even tried to get the publisher to say it was a poet's novel, because I really did think I was just operating with poetic constraints in prose. However, I can say that I think theater, and particularly poets' theater, which I've been doing a lot, is different because it's collaborative, unserious in a way that sometimes literary publishing can feel much more serious. And so it's really important to me to do these, like, poets theater things, or I take other people's books of poems and translate them for the stage. It's important because it's always completely amateur, and it feels really good and important to be an amateur. It's always, like, improvisational, kind of ad hoc, full of mistakes, but serious. Like, we're taking it seriously, but it is, you know, and also that it's collaborative, that, like, you can't really control anything from beginning to end. that sometimes meaning really isn't made until there's an audience, that the audience has to complete the meaning in a way that is really cool to see.
I don't know about you all, but I'm not entirely familiar with the mechanics of poetry. So I asked Professor Dennegan to delve a little deeper into the idea of a poet's play or a poet's novel.
You asked me the hardest question. So for example, in Slater Orchard, the novel, I decided that one thing that irks me somewhat about some fiction is that people just use words like just easily, like abundantly, like as if they're just everywhere and just no problem. I decided in that book that if I used a word, whatever word seemed most important on a page, then the next page I would have to investigate the etymology of it and the resonances of it, but within the plot. So the whole thing was sort of like an etymological like discourse, and I wouldn't let myself just go off where I wanted to unless it could follow the etymology. So constraints, I think, are the province of poetry, but other things too. But I do think that in poetry, language drives it. Language and rhythm more than anything, like more than character, more than plot, you know, it's language.
We also talked a little bit about writers dabbling in different forms of literature.
There are these two poets who are actually a couple, Keith and Rosemary Waldrop. They're both in their 80s, late 80s, and they're both really incredibly great poets and translators. I know Keith won a Pulitzer. Rosemary has won a lot of awards in multiple countries. I really love her poems. I love both of their poems. They live in Providence, and I learned when I moved to Providence that they had this poet's theater troupe in the 70s. And I was like, them? They're like poetry royalty, you know? Like, they're so serious. And I asked them about it, and they just were like laughing when I asked them about it. And it was just about like their friends and trying stuff out. And I think that all the theater stuff that I'm doing is much more about just like my friends and like having fun and being collaborative in like a way with literature that is not nothing you could ever win an award for or get famous for. And it's good. Yeah.
Professor Dennegan shared that plays are currently her favorite projects because they're new and therefore miraculous. What draws you to plays and playwriting?
As I mentioned, I didn't study playwriting or theater beyond going to a year of acting school and being asked to not come back. So I'm not trained in it. And I sort of been trying to write plays for like decades, but like they never really got anywhere. Mostly because nothing happened. Mostly because I'm 100% uninterested in plot. But I think I was finally exposed to other kinds of plays and performance art where plot is also not primary, and like completely found love with them. Not that there's no plot, but a writer like Adrienne Kennedy, she's a playwright, but she's also not as well known for it, but also a poet. Her plays are kind of like mindscapes, or people call them like nightmarescapes or dreamscapes, but you know, there's a lot of repetition. One character will have several names and several sort of like incarnations. There's absolutely impossible stage directions, like, you know, ravens are circling the ceiling and things like that. So she's like really not conscious of the play taking place like in a real theater. They really are taking place in a mind. And so like her most famous play is Funny House of a Negro, which is one that we read in modern drama. So in terms of plot, like what happens, maybe one thing happens, maybe, which I won't say because if anything does happen, it's on the last page. Adrienne Kennedy is like the most brilliant writer. I think she's like our best living playwright for sure. She has a play on Broadway right now, actually, which is like her first play was like 1964 on Broadway, and now she has one in 2023. Like, it's amazing. Anyway, I'm just shouting out everyone to go see it. But reading people like her made me see like there's other ways to write plays. And so, you know, it just feels like a miracle to be able to make things that can be voiced by other people that are not exactly poems, but also work a lot like poems.
I think now would be a good time to plug a blurb from her course description for modern drama. Why study modern and postmodern absurdist, surrealist, Dada-esque, non-naturalistic plays? One, to be okay with not knowing. Two, to engage in nonsense in the pursuit of sense. Studying these texts in their historical, political, and philosophical contexts will highlight the absurdity of humanity. And only if we can recognize our absurdity can we celebrate the possibility of non-absurdity. And three, to gather courage to go on with your life. Here comes another year, another semester, another day. Currently, Professor Dennegan is working on a libretto for a sung-through musical that's about bringing to life the situations in the paintings of, I'm going to say this name wrong and I apologize, Artemisia Gentileschi. Gentileschi was a Renaissance artist who broke several barriers for female Caravaggio painters during the 17th century. Professor Dennegan finds her work to be relevant and evocative.
She did these paintings, which, you know, at the time, like, they'd often, like, reinterpret biblical myths, for instance. She has these paintings of, you know, somewhat common figures. So the figure of Judith, who, you know, in biblical literature, beheaded, I'm not going to say his name right, Holofernes. And most, like, Caravaggio and, like, other painters, they don't necessarily depict Judith doing this act in, like, a maybe a realistic way. They make her beautiful, or they make her, like, daintily looking away from the blood, or, you know, but she has, like, this painting where she's, like, straddling him and, like, digging the knife in, and she's having, like, a maidservant help her do it, and they're, like, very much, like, in the act of murder. And she has other paintings about murder. She has a painting, again, like, a biblical story of Susanna in the garden, and the elders come, and they – everyone loves Susanna, and she's really beautiful, and the elders are like, have sex with us, and if you do, haha, you're defiled, and if you don't, we're going to tell everyone you did, and, you know, and so, and people have painted her for centuries, too, but her Susanna is, like, it's, like, so powerful because she's, like, has this look on her face that I think a lot of women will recognize, which is, like, I don't want to say yes, and I can't say no, like, this is such a dangerous position, and she doesn't have the, like, most depictions are like, I'm super sexy, or, you know, and her, you know, it's just, they feel so contemporary. They feel like, oh my God, this was my friend, you know, in college, or, you know, this happened to her.
I was curious as to why and how Professor Dennegan came to Artemisia's paintings, and here's what she shared with me. Quote, I came to Artemisia because I am, for lack of a better word, angry, frustratingly angry about male violence. It's close to home and nearly everywhere I look. It's our template. Artemisia Gentileschi's work offers this fantasy of female revenge through paintings like Judith beheading Holofernes. I love her depictions of this story because in them, the women are working together and are strong and committed to their acts. The revenge is the fantasy, but the strength is real. Professor Dennegan's favorite piece by Gentileschi is Self-Portrait as the Allegory of Painting. I found the painting to not only be beautiful and a testament to Gentileschi's talent, but reminiscent of the kind of teacher and woman Professor Dennegan is. I think it's pretty cool, which is why I chose to use the painting for the cover of this episode. To be the painter and the muse is an ideal form of strength, as Dennegan put it, and I found this paralleled her own ability to be a professor while remaining open and curious. So thinking outside of your work, out of, like, academics, outside of UConn, like, you as Darcy Dennegan, mm-hmm. like, if there was one thing you could get more people to care about, what would it be?
One thing that comes to mind, because I don't know about you, you know, in the middle of, like, all of, like, the dailiness of work and family and cleaning the cat litter box, which should have happened, like, last year, you know, like, in the middle of all the dailiness, it's, like, very hard to think, like, what is something I can do that would be, like, even the tiniest drop in, like, the oceans of misery. But I think a lot about people caught in the prison system, and there's a program in Providence. It's a national program, Black and Pink, where you can write letters to prisoners who identify as queer in some way, because they're often targeted, you know, in prisons. And I found out about it because they have this like holiday card writing thing where you just go and you can write holiday cards to anyone who signs up for Black and Pink. Like, I was like, oh, this is like, I could do this. And so, and anyway, you can have like a pen pal. But like the more that I like read about it and the more that I get involved, you know, obviously, I would tend toward like prison abolition, but like it's so easy to not think about something that we don't see and don't interact with. And like prisons used to be like in cities where like you could, there's this really great Grace Paley story, and you know, she's in the prison for some kind of protest, but it's like in the East Village or Greenwich Village, and they can like yell down to their families, and it used to be like you couldn't ignore it, and now it's just like, like so many things, like landfills and things, like you don't see them and you can ignore them. So I think to just think about the prison system, but also to think like if there's like, it's so easy to write a letter, you know, people really need contact, but it's like one of the easiest things I think we could do that might like help somebody that would otherwise be invisible to us.
So our last question is a quick rapid fire section.
Oh boy. So, all right, I'll be really short.
Yeah, okay. So I'll just like one question, first thing that comes to
okay.
your mind.
Okay. All right, Pascal, wow.
Ready?
Maybe.
Okay, so favorite poem?
First thing that comes to mind. Oh, God. Okay, yeah, all right, I got it. Hiromi Ito, Killing Kanoko.
Favorite city?
Los Angeles.
Favorite poet?
Living?
Or?
Well,
deceased?
I'm going to definitely say Hiromi Ito because she's definitely my favorite living poet. I have a lot of dead ones, but.
Yeah. Do you have any dead ones that you want to mention?
Bridget Pegeen Kelly.
Okay. Favorite play?
I mean, I'll definitely say an Adrienne Kennedy one since I already talked about her. But which one? Maybe? Yeah, okay. The Owl Answers by Adrienne Kennedy.
Okay. Favorite cuisine / favorite food?
Korean.
Nice. I'm assuming favorite playwright is Adrienne.
Living, yeah.
Deceased?
Eugenie Ionesco.
The last one, favorite color?
Green.
Nice.
What's your favorite color?
Brown. Yeah.
All shades, or do you have a particular?
Specifically, like Hershey chocolate brown, like that stereotypical brown color. Yeah, for sure. I also like gray a lot, like heather gray. Yeah.
I loved talking with Professor Dunnigan. Something I've always appreciated about English faculty here at UConn is their willingness to learn and grow. They genuinely enjoy working with and take a real interest in their students, and I found Professor Dunnigan to be a perfect example of that. I think it takes a lot to be consistently introspective. And I think, in addition to being refreshingly real and human, Professor Dunnigan embodies these traits naturally. Thank you for listening to this episode of Professors Are Cool People Too. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed producing it, and I'll catch you in the next one.